This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. Go to FUBARradio.com for more details. Screen Talk with Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.
Hello and welcome to Screen Talk. Listen, before I do an introduction to our guest and talk about me being away, I'm going to kickstart the show with my choice this week of piece of music or song from a film or TV show. This is, weirdly, I've picked a cover of a classic song that you might think cannot be bettered. And in a way, it probably can't be, but I do think this is a very good take on the song. This is from the Get Carter remake. I don't know if you remember this, but Sylvester Stallone, bless him, I love him, adore him, he thought it would be a good idea to remake Get Carter. Now, it's very, very rarely is it a good idea to remake an absolute classic, especially a cult classic, because you've got those fans that will hate you for even trying. One of the only times I think a film like that has been remade and actually weirdly they pulled it off was the recent Bad Lieutenant film, which was Werner Herzog made. He made that starring Nicolas Cage, and it was a cover. I suppose it could be considered a cover of the 90s film with Harvey Keitel, which was already considered a cult classic. But I can't think of many other times where that worked. This really didn't work. Michael Caine's in the film with Sly, which just, you know, sort of breaks your heart a bit. Like, Michael, why are you pissing over your own sort of canon of work? But the one thing I did like was this take on the theme tune, which is already a brilliant theme tune, but this one I just liked it. It had a bit of a new metal, that's it. It had a bit of a new metal thing going on. Anyway, I love this track. This is by Tyler Bates, and it is the Get Carter theme. It's a good track. I like that. It's just a shame it comes from a not very good film. I'm talking about the remake, of course, in case you've just tuned in. So I am back. I've been away for 7 months, which is insane. I feel like it was a week ago, but I have really missed doing this show, missed talking to you guys. We've been doing pre-records this week for some interviews that we'll be playing out over the weeks. There'll be some live shows coming up as well, but it's been fun. It's been really good talking. It's been nice to be back. I also did my first stand-up gig last night in almost 2 years, and that was fun as well. It's weird. I didn't want it to be fun. Some comedians sometimes say that stand-up is like a drug, or it's better than drugs or something, and they're right, but what people also don't say is that it's like drugs in the worst way possible as well, in that you get addicted to it and that you need that hit and you need that rush of hearing people laugh. Like, people will travel to, like, I don't know, to Gloucester or up to somewhere in Scotland. They'll travel all the way there just to do 15 minutes to get their little hit, which is probably like what, you know, drug addicts would do to get their hit, you know, travel anywhere and hang out in god-awful places just to get their little hit. And I actually felt like, having not done comedy for almost 2 years, that I'd sort of got it out of my system. And I was like, yeah, I'm free of it, man. I'm free of it. I don't need that anymore. And so I did this gig last night, and it was like, I've never done a gig where I hope I don't enjoy it. And sadly, I did. I fucking loved it. It was for charity. It was for Oxjam, which is a thing. It's like Oxfam's music thing. And they were a great crowd, and I loved it. And I spent the whole journey going home going, oh, God, do I do it again? Should I start it up again? Oh, dear. Anyway, that's a conflict, but this isn't. This is just a joy to be back. We have got, for our first show, a very special guest, someone I'm very excited to speak to. I'm talking about Simon Day, who, if you grew up in the 90s, if you're a teenager or in your 20s in the 90s, you'll know that he was part of a scene that was very important in the comedy world. He came up with some amazing characters like Tommy Cockles, Biddy Bleach, Dave Angel, in The Far Show I'm talking about. And he was a part of that whole Vic and Bob scene, and I had so much to ask him. It was very exciting. Here's a little sample of him in action. This was him doing Tommy Cockles.
My name is Edward Scissorhands, and no, not really. My name is Tommy Cockles, and I was born and raised in the musicals. Well, as I came here today, I saw a large coach motoring up the Strand, and it reminded me of a wonderful event in 1967. I remember the year well, because it was the year that Lamar from Kejagoogoo was born.
Him and that whole scene were a huge influence on me and the comedy world. I actually remember the first time I ever saw The Far Show, being blown away by that. Before he comes on the show, we're going to play his first choice of song. We get all our guests to pick a couple of songs. He chose this. This is the I can't remember what the name of this is, but this is, he'll tell us in a second, this is from the movie Blade Runner. This is Vangelis. We'll be right back.
Wow.
That is a mix of electro, timpani. I mean, that was what was weird about that was me and Simon, my guest today, were listening to that music, but also talking about arguing with our spouses. It was a very strange mix, kind of weirdly suited. Simon, thank you for joining us. Simon Day.
No problem at all. Nice to be here.
What made you pick the... Well, you actually picked the entire Blade Runner soundtrack. What made you pick that?
It's just, it's kind of, that film is a proper work of art, and I think the music is part of that work of art, and there's so many great bits of music on it. It's a lot of sort of DJs play it, don't they?
Yeah.
It became a sort of ambient, sort of classic thing. And
I was flicking through some of the tracks, just reminding myself, which, like, because I never know the names of the songs on that album, and I got to Love Theme, which... Yes. Is like a weird mix of sort of cool 90s ambient trance mixed with Kenny G.
Yeah. I mean,
the sax bit.
I like the first titles and that weird song, One More Kiss.
Yeah.
But it's all bound up with the film. And I've recently saw a documentary, which is about 3 hours long, about the making of the film, which is really interesting and has to be seen if you are any kind of film buff.
Are you excited about the new Blade Runner?
No.
No. Just simply, no. Just not even this possible soundtrack follow-up, because I believe they're going to try and keep it in...
Well, I suppose if they get Vangelis out, maybe something will happen, but...
Well, look, this seems like quite... I was going to save this until later and do your sort of talk about your work in more sort of chronological order, but actually, you know, what you've been doing more recently is sort of connected to the Vangelis world, and you just mentioned a three-hour documentary on Blade Runner. I'm a big fan of Brian Pern, and you did how many, because they were kind of like one-offs, weren't they, or two-parters?
We did sort of three sort of series in various, you know, lengths
of
time, you know, half hours, and some were 40 minutes, and then we did a sort of
Rhys Thomas
tribute.
Yeah.
Well, it's Rhys Thomas, really, with me in it, you know.
Yeah, and how did that come about? Did he just ask you, or did you chat about it?
We was talking about stuff and sending each other little films, as people do, and he said, have you seen... And we're big Peter Gabriel fans.
Yeah, and me too, by the way.
Yeah, and he sent me this film of Peter Gabriel, who appeared to be very reluctantly talking to his fans. You know, he would always have a huge sort of tour set behind him, and it really felt like they'd gone, you've got to, you know, talk to your fans, what people do now, Peter. And he'd go, hello, it's me here. As you can see, we've just got some problems. We're in Copenhagen. And it was all... And he really has not... He's not a person who likes to be in front of a camera.
Yeah.
He's a genius songwriter and performer, but that's just not his thing, and as it shouldn't be, you know. And Rhys just said, look, this is really funny. You could do that, you know. And he got me back to his house, and we started doing it. And I was really unconvinced that there was any mileage in it. I just said, yeah, but he's quite dull the way he speaks.
Yeah.
And admittedly, I could get the impression off, and people who knew...
I was going to say that the impression is really good. But it's such a niche impression. You couldn't go on BBC One at 9 o'clock, you know, going, guess who this is? Everyone would be like, who the fuck?
Do you keep Peter Gabriel? Yeah,
Ronnie Corbett, Peter Gabriel, and, you know.
Yeah, exactly. But he, you know, Rhys,
but it's good. It's really accurate. It's that. It's not just like, because he speaks in that weird hushed tone, but you've actually got the strange staccato intonation thing.
Yeah, it's like
he does.
He's got indigestion. And so... We said no. It's very hard, but yeah, and Rhys, you know, genius that he is, he just completely we're going to do this and drove it, and it just grew and grew and grew and grew, and you know, I sort of wanted it to be more very much like the BBC documentaries on BBC Four, quite dull. And he was like, no, let's make it really funny, and he made it a lot funnier and more stupid, and put lots of
stuff
in it.
At the beginning, it was more. It was much more closer to the career he had, right?
Yeah.
And then you started branching out and having him do like Britpop or different kinds of things. I mean, I love the... I was rewatching some stuff yesterday, but just like the stuff where you have him singing the world music stuff, and like it's just... I mean, I wonder if it's because I'm a huge Peter Gabriel fan. Yeah. I've actually seen Rhys at Peter Gabriel shows.
Yeah.
But I wonder if it's because I know that detail, because there was a thing about where you're playing music with gorillas, and Peter Gabriel actually did that.
Done that. Yeah.
So I'm wondering how many people... I mean, that's funny anyway, if you know that anyway.
Well, yeah, I think people who know, they send stuff and say, look, this is Peter Gabriel, but I mean, the bottom line is the industry really like it, and Reese got so many, because Reese is really good at getting people to be in it. He writes to them, and the people that turned out, who came down to London for sort of, you know, 200 quid, you know, Roy Wood, and one day we had Sporty Spice, Roy Wood, Chrissy Hynde, and they're all coming in and out, these people, and you've got to sort of say, we're not taking the mickey out of you. And Reese is really good
sounds
at all
like
that.
Band-Aid.
It was like Band-Aid. Yeah, and there was, you know, loads of people came past through the show, and then you had sort of Michael Kitchen doing John Farrow, which was kind of, I think he should have sort of won something for that. It was just such a brilliant. I watched one the other night with him doing, with a lot of him talking.
Yeah.
And he's so brilliant in it.
Yeah, he's a great.
And he kind of held it all up. It was good for me because I was kind of like the straight man, and I kept saying, well, I don't want any lines. And we just go, don't worry, it's just you reacting in the awkwardness, you know, of Peter Gabriel. You imagine what he doesn't really want to be with lots of people.
Yeah, I mean, it is funny though, because there's something about the how serious he's taking everything in some of these bizarre, like when he goes into the, is it like caves or something?
Yeah.
And you're like, you know, it's just this.
But I mean, I met him. It was terrifying meeting him because I always thought he would be short because my logic was he was very handsome on the front cover of So.
Yeah.
Right. Incredibly handsome. I thought he's going to be one of these little handsome blokes with a big head. And then Reese.
Do you mean ego or literally big head?
No, I mean a big head. Like, you know, you get the sort of the Dustin Hoffman model of famous actors. And Reese wrote to him and said, you know, we were big fans, and I don't know if you've seen this and this thing we've done. Or he actually came out online and said, someone's taking a mickey at me, but it's okay, blah, blah. Went to see the show and then met him backstage at halftime. In fact, he said, Peter's ready to meet you now. And he's sort of taller than me. And
really?
I was just really sort of embarrassed. I didn't even know what to say.
You're a tall man as well.
Yeah, he's my size. I just felt a bit embarrassed. I think I dropped my crisps. You know what I mean?
The worst thing you could have done right then.
Yeah, they were beef and onion as well.
You're showing your class there with your beef and onion crisps. They're definitely my least favourite, I'm afraid.
No, I don't eat beef and onion. No. It's disgusting.
Okay. Yeah. That I would be quite nervous to meet him anyway, but let alone having kind of mocked, not mocked, but...
Well, you are mocking him because you're doing the stuff in there and...
But they say, you know, it's, you know... The best form of flattery or something when you impersonate people.
I think he was like, oh, I'm surprised anyone's interested in me you know, anymore.
Oh, Peter.
But he's a really nice guy.
Yeah.
And he got it and he was very funny. Although, this is a showbiz anecdote. This doesn't happen very often. We were having dinner with Peter Gabriel and the bloke out of Queen, the drummer, Roger.
Yeah.
And we're talking about Brian Pern and Reese goes, yeah, but he loves it. And me and Eric Clapton both said this at the same time. Yeah, but he has to. You know what I mean? Because you can't go, it's rubbish. You know what I mean?
Because
people have obviously gone, have you seen this?
Yeah.
And his family and people who know him.
Yeah, because he would just look like a right grump if he said anything else, of course.
Exactly.
Of course. So just quickly to round off this sort of area of your work, what is your favourite Peter Gabriel album?
Oh, I'm going to be boring and go for So.
It's just
such a great album. When you actually listen to it now,
it's still
how
amazing.
Odd it is.
No, but it's, that the last three songs go in this really weird. Yeah.
And that was like Americans going, that great song. Yeah. I mean, it was a massive American smash, wasn't it?
Yeah. People who heard Sledgehammer were like, what is going on? Why is this album just ended on this weird. Yeah. But the it's almost like spoken word poetry with beats underneath
it. I think my favourite track on it actually is.
Have you seen the documentary of.
Yes,
that's brilliant, good, isn't it?
But with Daniel Lanois, going
so
just
good.
Really sort of, you really get the anger, don't you? Yeah. He would come in and I would smash his phone.
Yeah,
it's really.
He locked him in a shed at one point just to get him to finish those. I actually met Daniel Lanois and he was lovely, and I was like, you've actually produced or co-produced some of my all-time favourite albums. I can't believe, you know, when you're especially for me when I was a teenager, when albums mean that much to you. And he was so sweet, actually. You're doing a show at Edinburgh, right?
I am doing 5 nights at Edinburgh, 16th, what? 16th to the 20th.
Have you done Edinburgh before?
Years ago. But I kind of,
because
I was quite lucky, I worked with Jim and Bob very quickly. I didn't need to do Edinburgh in terms of making a name for myself. And I always sort of went up just with Malcolm Hardy and did a sort of variety show.
Mm-hmm.
I never did my own, right, I'm going to Edinburgh, I'm really going to smash down the doors and everyone's going to know it's me.
And was it, what sort of era are we talking here?
90s.
Early 90s.
Yeah, go up. I remember sitting with John Juan de Perrier with Steve Coogan.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's a funny story, actually, and we said, and John was like, you know, it's John Thompson, right? Yeah, John Thompson, it's all him. He all presses him. I was in the show. I said, well, we'll do a show next year, me and you.
Yeah.
And he said, okay. But I said, we'll get Caroline involved, Caroline Ahern. Yeah. And so we asked her. She went, all right, yeah, why not, you know. And then we proceeded to go and sort of buy some pads and pencils and sort of sat down to write it. And 9 months later, yeah, we'd eaten a lot of crisps and watched a lot of Christopher Walken films. We hadn't written anything. She had sort of realised, Caroline, this was a terrible error on the part of her career. So we went up to stay in the house and we kind of knocked out a few sketches, but we had a room booked and it was quite a big deal, you know. We called the show Do You Like Us?
And which is slightly dangerous.
We hadn't worked out that when we went off stage that it would be silent and nothing would happen. It was that cack-handed. And Coogan came to watch the first night. And there was one bit where we did a song, like a sort of spoof, you know, song.
So all three of you were still, you all committed to the show?
Yeah, we'd written bits of it. And Caroline was kind of like terrified. She knew it was going to go badly wrong. Me and John, we were kind of that thing, you know what, we get away with it. We'll get up on stage and do some bits and bobs. And then it happened, and we had quite a big sort of number at the start of the song. Caroline sort of walked off stage halfway through it, and there was this terrible moment. It all went quiet, and our agents were just clapping, going like that, with the music playing.
Oh, my God.
And it went sort of sold out, 160, 12, none, and we sort of cancelled it. That was 1992, yeah. But
God, and it just went downhill from there, didn't it, for you?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, it's good to know that even people that ended up, you know, getting their own TV shows and things have Edinburgh so bad they have to cancel the show.
You've got to have a nuts and bolts man. That's like Henry's. I'm not calling him that. I just did, but you need someone there who's going to do all the stuff. And me and John are just pure performers, and so is Caroline. Without a Craig Cash or a Charlie Higson or whatever.
Yeah.
Someone's going, well, how is that going to work? You just can't do it because you have great big flights of fancy while you're writing.
Yeah.
But unless someone's dotting the I's and crossing the T's, that's what it will be. And you might get away with it.
Yeah.
But we didn't.
I worked with someone years ago in sketch comedy who is just he was so inherently funny that even if he had not contributed as much to the writing of that sketch or something, we'd perform it and he got all the biggest laughs and you'd be like, oh, you fucker.
Yeah, that's annoying. Yeah. That happens a lot.
Yeah. Because he's just had funny bones, you know? And did you enjoy doing Edinburgh back then? What is your, like, because you're
with
about
Malcolm,
to...
it was great because I'd go up and he'd hire two, you know, we once did me, Boothby Graffo and Terry Rogers, who was a sort of foul-mouthed 65-year-old ventriloquist woman.
Mm.
We lived with her as well and she was crackers, you know. I just enjoyed it then, but
Was it still important for performers back then? Was it like it is now? Did people think, oh, I've got to do Edinburgh and I've got to crack it and all that?
Yeah, the Perrier was a big deal. Perrier was a massive deal and everyone was like, wow,
yeah,
won the Perrier, you know. So
I sort of feel like that award doesn't mean as much anymore.
Doesn't mean anything.
Nothing. In fact, it's a curse.
But I mean, now Edinburgh, kind of you realise Edinburgh is a thing on its own and it happens and it doesn't really bleed into
the rest
real
of the
world,
yeah.
I think. I mean, who knows? Because I haven't been, but...
I think also, since not that I'm sort of holding up the fizzy water in any sort of esteem, but just the title, the minute they lost that sponsorship, it kind of like, well, what is the award? It's the something award, so I don't know if that means as much.
FA Cups, isn't it, become the... You know.
So you grew up in Camberwell, right?
No, I grew up near Camberwell. My Wikipedia's been interfered with, I think, by Reese.
Are you implying that I only did my research on Wikipedia? I just thought I knew that through...
No, I grew up in Greenwich, which is just down the road.
Okay, yeah.
Yes, about 2 miles away.
And sort of in the late 80s, early 90s, there was a bit of a scene, comedy scene in the South East London, right?
Yeah, I mean, I was gardening and, you know, I was 29, didn't know what I was going to do. I was sort of kind of the black sheep of the family thing. And Jim and Bob suddenly appeared in a little council estate near me, literally like that, and they started writing above my mate's fireplace shop.
Serious?
Yeah, and it was like they'd come, it's really odd, and we started knocking around them a bit. My mate said, look, you're funny, you should write something. And he was this guy that was very anal, and we wrote this stand-up set, and we really rehearsed it and nailed it and put all my sort of angst over the last, you know, because I always wanted to do something like that, but I never had the confidence. Did a talent night and then won it, and then Jim and Bob were there. They were judging and they went, right, you can come on tour with us.
Yeah.
I went straight on tour with them. So my third gig was in front of 1,000 sort of students, drunk students. And I used to die virtually every... I did Tommy Cockles and I would die
Yeah.
Most nights. They'd kind of realise that it wasn't part of Jim and Bob's show.
Yeah.
And I've since met comics who said, oh, I was there for that and I watched you were great, Johnny Vegas or whatever.
Yeah. And what was the inspiration of Tommy Cockles? Like, why? Because that seems like such an bygone era.
I mean, it was a guy who hadn't really, he'd been on, when you ever see a documentary, there's one guy you don't recognise, who claims to be the sort of best friend of the person, and is slightly bitter. That's how it started. and sort of goes, well, and they always call the person by their first name.
Yeah.
Like, if you get a documentary, people say, well, Mike Caine, you know, Mike's a great guy. And it came out of that. And the comedy is sort of, it's Peter Cook, Dudley Moore, that sort of stuff of inserting celebrities into real life. Who looked out the window? Who was it? You know, I can't do it because it's quite rude.
You can say whatever you want on this.
Oh, okay. I can't remember the sketch exactly. So it was kind of like, you know, let's make him old, but he's talking about the Shaman one week, and then he's talking about, you know, the musicals. And that was kind of just a surreal element of it, really.
So what had you done in your 20s before you did comedy?
Well, I was in a band when I was 16, and that all sort of fell apart because my parents broke up, and I was sort of a bit, you know, I was a bit confused, and I just sort of did jobs. I was just did jobs and hung around and sort of, you know, slept on people's sofas and never really had any.
Because I would have definitely had you down as an Oxbridge type. I thought you came up through the footlights.
Yeah, I did. Yeah,
it seems to me like there was There was definitely like the anti-footlights thing in that era as well. A lot of people that were from working class doing like, but surreal stuff as well. And
I think there was a good time for comedy, you know. It was just the TV companies were like, really, we're going to invest in this, you know, Jim and Bob, because Jim and Bob was such a massive hit.
Mm.
And so then that, you know, that generation, you had Chris Morris and you had, you know, Father Ted came out of that. There was a lot of good people who were just all Monty Python fans, really, who grew up in Monty Python. You know, it was hardwired into the Monty Python, and then the stand-up thing happened, and perhaps weren't, you know, I didn't realise until I read about it all how sort of left-wing the first wave of comics were, and they were quite angry, and it was like, get rid of Bernard Manning, you know, and his mother-in-law jokes. If you ask them now, Ben Elton, about mother-in-laws, they'll probably go, they're probably quite happy to tell a few jokes about them.
Yeah. I feel like that sort of humour without the bigotry or racism has come back a bit, like people talking about doing routines about their wives or their...
It has, totally. Like, it's gone full circle. Yeah. And that's a lot to do with budgets, and people can't afford to go out and make a Mighty Boosh because it's too expensive and will it work? And we need the viewers now. So they have, you know, McIntyre introducing, you know, Bishop or whatever, and it's very easy. People go, oh, I see. He's making a joke about that. And it's kind of... although these people are good, you know, some are brilliant, some aren't, although they're great comics, you can't really tell watch them on TV. It's easy for the TV companies now to do that. And as David Quantock said the other night, oh, it's Friday night, there's that four stand-ups sitting behind a desk.
Yeah.
That is, you know, that is comedy on TV now, largely.
Yeah. I also feel like it's a kickback against the fact that probably for a decade or so, the mainstream were a bit ignored. In terms of comedy.
Definitely. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, because you talk to some of the old comics and they just say all the places have closed.
Yeah.
You know, there's no real sort of room for them.
So how did you get to meet Paul and Charlie, and how did the whole Far Show thing? Because that was like the real sort of turning point.
Yeah,
you,
well,
like,
they used to come to Up the Creek and watch me.
Yeah, and which, by the way, was such an amazing... I mean, it still is, but the first time I ever saw a live comedy... Like, went to a comedy club, was up the creek, because I grew up in Beckenham. We went and saw Malcolm doing his thing. I think he got his cock out at some point. And it was like, there was such an energy. There was such a, like comedy clubs in that time were such a thrilling place to be.
Yeah, but I mean, South East London was always very cut off, and it was always, you know, and it's only now they've got the tubes. You know, when I grew up, I had to get a bus and a train, an overground train, to get to Charing Cross, let alone get to...
Yeah.
So it was always very of itself, you know, and that whole sort of level of humour, you know, but...
Do you think it was like people were almost starting their own scene because it was easier to do it locally than keep travelling across London?
I think so. I think it was just luck for me. I mean, you know, in terms of my career, people said, oh, you know, they used to call it the something mafia, you know, because Jules Holland and Jim and Bob. But he had a recording studio and they had a shop there, and they sort of made friends because they all rode old motorbikes. That was kind of... It wasn't really a career move.
Yeah. So Paul and Charlie saw you.
Yeah, they used to come down there, and I remember Paul saying, all right, he said, we're doing a show with characters, you know, short, sharp characters. You'd be great in it. Because I used to do different characters, and I used to do a Krusty, and I did a...
I would have liked to see Robert the Krusty.
I did a Krusty who had a trust fund, you know.
Yeah.
That was early 90s, way before anyone else. And I did a few different characters, and they just thought, you'll be great. It's going to be... Because I don't know if you know the story was they were watching a Harry Enfield, and they're watching some clips of it with all the sketches shortened.
Yeah.
And they went, this is funnier than the actual show.
Yeah. I didn't know that. I knew that they wanted to sort of like cut to the meat or the bones of it, or, you know, and sort of the punchline, hence the fast show. But I didn't know it was from watching a highlight version of their own, the show they worked on.
That made them.
Yeah. It's like, quite. We could do this even better and faster. And
that's why Harry was always a bit light about it. You know?
And because it feels like that was quite a cultural, a sort of pop culture moment, that show, which was on BBC Two, and now it's like really hard for shows to like pop through like that. And
it's the usual thing. We did the first series; they were umming and ahhing, and Jeff Perkins, God rest his soul, he said, "No, you've got to make another series. This is good. These people are good. They know what they're doing." And I don't know if people know who Jeffrey Perkins was, but he was this amazing producer that basically acted as a buffer between performers and the BBC. And he would go to the BBC. He did it with Karen Tate. He did it with so many shows. With Catherine Tate, they wanted to cancel with the Royal Family. They didn't get that.
Yeah.
And he said, look, this is good. And he knew. And that is one of the problems. We don't have those people anymore at the BBC who are all, you know, they're knowledgeable about what is a good show. Now at the BBC, people just frightened for their job, and it's all...
Well, even before, like, when I first started doing stuff, like, I'm talking, going back to the 70s or whatever, I see documentaries where people, like, they go, yes, you know, like, John Cleese or someone said, so we went to the BBC, and then, you know, we said, what about this? And then we're like, no, we're just not sure.
Yeah.
And we said, oh, go on. And he went, oh, all right, then, we will. And you're like, well, that was it.
Exactly.
Oh, then we jumped in a taxi across town to ITV, and they said, okay, they'll do it. And it's like, oh, my God.
I know.
It just sounds like bliss.
I know, God. Now it's like some sort of strange Russian federation, isn't it?
I heard a story that when they script, because some of the sketches of the Far Show were not in front of an audience, they were location sketches, and they had to film them in front. And there was literally no laughter, because it's all about knowing what the running joke is. You know, you start finding it funny once you got what the repeating gag or whatever is.
Yeah.
That there was like quite a muted response in the laughter track, and they were like,
definitely.
"Oh my god, but this is."
It was a tough thing because you had Paul and Charlie, who were sort of good cop, bad cop, and you had to go and do your stuff to them in a rehearsal room, and Charlie would be like a scientist going, "Yeah, so what's the joke?" And Paul would be more on the performer's side. But, you know, I never thought... I didn't really get the Far Show repetition thing. And I remember I didn't really do the catchphrases thing.
Yeah.
And Charlie once took me aside with Dave Angel. No, with Monkfish. And said, well, you need a catchphrase. It's a bit like a headmaster. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you know, everyone's got a catchphrase. Even James Bond's got a catchphrase. And I said, yeah, but he hasn't got a catchphrase, right? Because I wanted to be the sort of maverick wild guy.
You're the non-catchphrase guy
the show,
in the catchphrase show.
Yeah, exactly. And he said, well, how about... And we went to all these things. Well, how about put your niggas on and make me a cup of tea? And I was like, yeah, that'll do. Or I don't know where he came up with it, but, you know, it was very funny. And that's what I'm saying. You need someone there who has an idea of what it is.
Yeah, yeah. That's great. And at what point did you all start going, oh, you know, was there a point where one of you called up the other one and went... I think something's happening here.
Yeah, I can't remember. Probably the second series took off. It really did take off. And it's kind of now, it's like it's as big as ever. I get more people coming up to me now. Yeah, pretty much. Well, I don't go out at night, so I don't really know that, but I get a lot of
people. No one knows it at night.
No. It's very nighttime.
Daytime, it's very popular.
That's.
I mean, it's quite... That's quite a nice feeling to know that 20 years later it's
still... Well, people grew up with it and they go... And I'm sure they say it to people who... Loads of shows, but they say, you know, your show, I show it to my son, and it meant a lot to me. But in fact, my kids now, they watch Vines, which are essentially sort of brainless Far Show sketches.
Yeah.
Little sketches of people running in with a wig on and going, and throwing some water on someone. But they are kind of short sketches.
Yeah. I remember when I first saw it, a friend of mine, Ollie, sent... I was at his house and he had a VHS of it, which was... people like teenagers now who can have every single thing ever made on Netflix for $5.99 a month will not believe this. It was like a VHS with three episodes that cost him $9.99. And I just couldn't believe what I was watching. It was like, but it seems weird that it was revolutionary at the time.
Well, that's what I said to Paul the other day.
Like
on
now,
the phone.
It's like that's what everyone's doing. But at the time,
I saw that because it's been on again on Gold, isn't it? And I watched the first series. To me, it's not that funny. Quite a lot of it's slightly. But as Paul said at the time, it was very different.
Yeah. What was your of all your characters? Which leads me to the Edinburgh show. What? Which was your like? Did you have a favourite or a couple of favourites?
Yeah, I liked the competitive dad because I kind of got the message across there. Then that was a sort of good little thing. I mean, some of the others were more stand-up characters that I moved into the Fast Show.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like Billy Bleach, I was doing stand-up before the Fast Show.
Why did you make... Because your characters are often quite working-class, sort of pub culture types. Why did you make competitive dad like a middle-class...
Because he was there was a little bit of my dad there.
Really?
Yeah, a little bit of my dad. Because my dad was actually, my mum was working class, my dad was public school, so he was a bit like that. He wasn't nasty, but he had that sort of total, you know, he would go for a walk and he would just walk in front and you had to sort of keep up with him. And then that was like it, that. You know. That.
My girlfriend says I do that. Annoyingly.
I think men do it, don't they?
Steam ahead. So that's interesting. I wouldn't have... So you grew up with like a real mix of
Mum was from the Midlands.
Right.
She was a nurse, and my dad was sort of proper, you know, Oxbridge. Yes.
And then they brought up a South London oik.
Yeah, exactly.
That's amazing.
Well, I became an oik to sort of stop myself getting beaten up at my school. I went to a sort of
a rough school.
Yeah.
And did you have what sort of trouble did you get into?
Oh, you know, usual stuff. Parents broke up. So, and people talk about sofa surfing and all that now, but I actually didn't like it. And people seem to talk about it like it's okay to sort of sleep on people's floors, but I found it very sort of depressing. I was actually very depressed. And
even as a teenager?
Yeah, from 16, I was lost. I was in squats and shoplifting, and then I went to ball stall, and I was really gone, you know.
Wow.
Yeah, so, but I always watched people.
Yeah.
And I've always been a listener. Like, a good character comic can't, you know, it's all very well... banging on telling people about your jokes, but I'm happy to sit, you know, and I've sat in a lot of pubs. I've done that. I've sat in libraries, you know.
Well, that's why I love, one of my favourite characters is Billy Bleach, because the detail of which, you know, only someone that has been in those places knows that character that well.
I used to do that. I was addicted to fruit machines, and I used to go up and help people and then get it wrong. I remember one bloke, and I said, I'll do it for you, and sort of barged in, and then lost the money. You know, you're talking about a fiver in sort of 1979. And then they sort of look at you like, what have you done?
Well, I was rewatching some of it yesterday, and it was like the amount of... hold the bells. There you go. Oh, that's weird. That's weird. And it's like, that's weird is your response to every time he loses. That was cracking me up. Dave Angel was also hugely popular amongst me and my mates.
Was myth? Mike Read.
Was it?
Yeah. I thought, make Mike Read, because I read his book and loved his book. Yeah. Terrific. And one story where he works at a warehouse and he claims that they had a rat problem, so he just started biting through their necks and hurling them into a pile.
Really?
That's one of his stories. And I thought,
why he's got those false teeth. He ate too many rats.
Exactly. I thought, what would he not care about? Global warming.
Yeah.
And I just thought, I like to juxtapose things with people, do you know what I mean?
I was going to say, was that really based on Mike Read? You go, no, of course it wasn't. It was just Mike Read.
Yeah. Well, I met a guy the other day who got my autograph and said he went up to Mike Read once and mentioned Dave Angel. He went, oi, we don't talk about him in RS.
Serious?
Yeah, so I'm glad I never met Mike Read, because I would have really been
terrified. Wouldn't have been the Peter Gabriel experience, that's for sure.
Come here.
You ain't terrific.
And we'd ask for sort of 20% of my earnings,
Of course he would. Oh, man. Because, you know, I like we all do, I can really go down a YouTube wormhole. And I ended up watching about 20 minutes of a Mike Read special. This is about 2-3 weeks ago. And lots of the cast of EastEnders were in... it was kind of spellbinding, but just how nonsensical it was. Like there was like no link between the jokes or anything,
and they just told jokes,
you know, with a fag on and a pint in his hand, and I'm like, oh, what happened to
they
that?
They also told each other's jokes.
Did they?
There was a joke going around. They all told it.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, that's a shame you can't do that anymore.
Yeah,
isn't it?
It is a shame.
It would really solve a few problems. So you're taking some of these characters, some of your beloved characters up to Edinburgh. Which ones are you doing?
I am doing Billy Bleach.
Yeah.
And I am then doing Geoffrey Allerton, the Yorkshire poet, who's a relatively new character we did on Bellamy's People, the cancelled TV show. Then I am doing...
Another great show, by the way.
Tony Beckton, the gangster,
who was
on that too, who's done 27 years in prison, and I'm finishing off with a bit of Brian Pern.
Okay, nice. So will you do some music then?
Yeah, a couple of songs. Yes. I mean, Edinburgh's only an hour, so I've got to crowbar it all in.
And then is this to launch a tour or some more
tour
shows?
In October.
Great.
Which will be a proper show, and I'm doing three warm-ups this week. I'm doing one in Windsor on Thursday night, Windsor Fire Station, and two on Saturday, on Sunday and Monday at the Albany in Great Portland Street.
Yeah. Okay, I love that venue. It's lovely.
Yeah. It's a good venue, apart from the fact it doesn't advertise the fact that anything's on there.
No, but hey, come on, you know, who needs to advertise you're on?
Well, they do.
I was, obviously, because you corrected me with where you grew up, I did look on Wikipedia just to see if there's anything about you I didn't really know or anything. I didn't know that you had done a stint on Holby City.
I played a
guy. Or Casualty? Was it Holby or Casualty?
It's Holby, yeah. I played a guy who had banged his head. He'd been a long-serving caretaker guy who banged his head and then got a bit weird and nasty.
Was it just one episode?
I think it's a few. Two.
Oh, I thought for the way I read it, I thought it was like you were a regular for a while.
No, I met Robert Powell and all that. He was good. Nice man.
The original Jesus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I said, do you mind talking about it? He said, why would I? Made my whole career.
Do you know, it's weird that when you do something that that you think was like just part of a bigger thing.
Yeah.
There's an actor called Ben Chaplin.
I know Ben Chaplin.
Great actor, done lots of amazing work. I met him once, we were chatting, and he said he still, the thing he gets asked about is the sitcom Game On from the 90s, which he was actually only even in the first series, and then Neil Stuck took over for series 2 and 3.
Yeah.
And yet he still, like all the films he's done, all the good, you know, like big...
Well, people are just like, that's the way they are, and it's a bit like, I don't want to particularly... I'd rather, if I go and see Steely Dan, I don't want to hear them do, you know, I want to see the old stuff.
Yeah.
And people come up to me in the street and go, oh, Farshow, that was brilliant. Doing any more? And I say, well, no, we did do, and you go on this grid, and then you, well, what are you up to now? So you talk about Brian Pern for 10 minutes, and they go, yeah, that Farshow was brilliant.
You just see the glazed look in their eyes. I actually saw Sylvester Stallone interviewed, and where he said he spent about 20 years hating that everyone just thought he was Rocky.
Yeah.
And then one day went, hang on, I've created a character that people 30 years later are still talking about and love.
Yeah.
I should be happy. That's an amazing achievement.
Yeah.
You know, but I think people do come full circle with their own work. Like,
I think it's harder if you're not working and you've got no money. You know, that's difficult. But I think if, you know... I mean, what amazes me about Rocky is that actual boxers love it. Real boxers.
Yeah, though it's so unrealistic.
I know, they play the music and they train to it. And Rocky was what got me into boxing. And I think, but it's so not like boxing.
Yeah.
Boxing is so much harder.
That is weird, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, Bill Conti, he must be so chuffed that that song will never go away, ever.
I know.
As long as boxing lives. Are you a boxing fan?
I am, yeah.
Are you?
Big
what do you
fan.
Think about this Mayweather?
I think... you know, it's Las Vegas, it's a pantomime, and they're both going to make a hell of a lot of money. They probably have a rematch, and it doesn't really matter, and he'll get beaten, the Irish fella.
It's the only match. Do we call it a match or a game or a fight?
It's all
those
things.
It's a fight, isn't it? It's the only fight where it's not a case of who, in my opinion, not a case of who you want to win, but who you want to lose.
Yeah.
Because, I mean... I hate to say this, but it's like they don't come across as the nicest guys in the world,
no,
do they?
I think, but yeah, that sells fights, doesn't it? I mean, in fact, David Haye, they're talking about that. There might be another one of those.
Maybe they'll like have three-way fights because anything can happen now. Now we're so David Haye gets in as well, and it's a scrap. It's just a pub scrap, isn't it?
Yeah.
With one guy trying to do all the rules, like the proper
but
boxing.
Surely he's gonna. He's if he's being humiliated. McGregor, surely he will suddenly just lose it, as might you know, and try and get him in a headlock or sort of elbow him or knee him in the goo.
Yeah, how can he not? It's so programmed in his brain to be able to do those moves.
Exactly.
Is he not allowed? Because he's playing by boxing rules, right?
It's Queen's rules, and he cannot beat Mayweather. You know, everyone's going, oh, yeah, but he's different. And listen, they've all tried to beat Mayweather. Fast, young, lunatics, big punches, you know, measured boxers. They've all been reduced to exactly the same. He makes them all look the same. So there's no way that this guy has been boxing, who can't, he's not a skilled boxer, you know.
And he's, and the problem is he's sort of unlikable, Mayweather, I think. So
yeah, as he's traded on that.
He is.
He realised he needed something, so he decided to be the bad guy a long time ago. Because when he first came out, he was a nice young, you know, Olympic champion kid, and he was great. And then he realised that you need to have something to make people buy tickets. So he went down that road of being the sort of...
What would your thing be?
If I was a boxer?
Yeah.
I was going to be a boxer in something. I can't remember. I got asked to do that boxing thing. You know, Bob Mortimer fought.
Yeah.
They asked me to do it. I was going to be the full English, Simon the full English Day.
I like that.
But they asked me, would I fight Tony Hadley or John Pienaar? And I sort of spoke to a couple of persons. They said, John Pienaar has apparently been in the gym. He's been knocking people out and sort of smashing the big bag off its rope.
Yeah.
I thought, I don't want to fight Tony Hadley anyway. He's probably way tougher than me because I'm a heavyweight.
But is he, Tony Hadley, I think he's got quite an annoying singing voice. You could sort of hone in on that, couldn't you?
I imagine he's probably quite tough to
I reckon he is.
When the, you know, the chips are down.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Literally.
Especially
when
if
we put the chips down and start training.
Especially if it was in that interim between Spandau Ballet splitting up and getting back together. He had a lot to prove in those
exactly.
years.
Exactly.
You know, he would not let a comedian take him down. Okay, well, look, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. I did want to... We do this piece about guilty pleasure films or TV shows, but
I think it won.
You said to me that you told our producer.
No,
that
I know
you,
I did. It came across
nothing
very
you
badly.
Feel guilty about.
Well, I'm a bit annoyed about this whole thing of the Love Island thing. Everyone going, it's great.
Okay.
Yeah. I just,
have you watched it though?
No. I won't watch it.
No, I haven't watched it.
No, but I
is it on principle alone?
Yeah, I just don't get this whole... Having got kids now, this whole body thing, I just, you know, it's really important to look like this. And if you don't look like this, you're not a cool person. I think it's very dangerous for young kids. I've said my bit. However, Rhys has introduced me to, and someone mentioned this earlier, the films of Michael Winner.
Yes.
And he's made...
Which is an entire catalogue of guilty pleasures.
In fact, I think Rhys did watched Bullshot. We talked about Bullshot. There's another one.
Bullseye.
Yeah.
Well, so we have Reese
Thomas.
Well, Reese Shearsmith from League of Gentlemen, who you've worked with before, right?
I know him.
What was Vic and Bob's? What was the show they did? The sitcom-y, the two characters up in
Catterick.
Catterick, yeah.
I did a tiny bit.
I think Reese was in that. Anyway, he picked Bullseye as well. Yeah. Have you seen it? Did you watch it? Yeah.
It's one of the most confusing films ever made. I mean, it's great watching it with Reese because he'll just tell you. He made a later one starring Chris Rea, which was basically like...
What was that called? Something...
It was basically like...
Was that called Parting Shots?
Parting Shots.
Yeah. Oh, my God. And Catherine Zeta-Jones, was she in
there? There's one moment where he dives into a swimming pool and then when he gets out, he's a different person. It's a brilliant shot. He obviously had to go.
You mean that wasn't meant to happen?
No, he dives in.
And they just got a double
to
get out.
Yeah, the double gets out with completely different shoulders for the hairy back.
That is phenomenal. That's the thing that got me about Bullseye was there are films that are bad because maybe like the story isn't working or it's just a bit crap or something. But actually, it's badly made.
Yeah.
And he's made some technically...
Proper films.
Yeah. So, but yet there's this thing where like... You know, the character points to the bus, and then when we cut to the bus, it's not in the area that he's pointing to, you know. It's just weird. I'm going to have to check out Parting Shots now.
Yeah,
just
check
for that
all
bit.
Out.
Yeah. It's hard to pick a guilty pleasure, though, isn't it, sometimes? Because you're like,
I don't know. The whole guilty pleasures thing, it was Sean Rowley, wasn't it, back when I used to know him in 1990, and we would go to these sort of clubs and go back to people's houses. It was all very cool. They were playing house music. Me and him would try and put on Peter Gabriel.
Yeah.
Or sort of, you know, early Fleetwood Mac. And that's how he started doing that. So I would like to think that I had my part in the start of Guilty Pleasures.
I think you did. I think people call it Simon Day's Guilty Pleasures. My producers just told me that Parting Shots also had Bob Hoskins in it.
That's right. He was in that too.
Oliver Reed, who is...
His mates, basically.
Yeah, all his mates. Ollie Reed. Yeah. It's amazing no one's really done a comic comic creation based on him, really.
And it's a shame, really, because he was such a brilliant actor in Oliver. I mean, he is so brilliant. But, you know, he preferred the world of the light and lager and other things.
Was that his drink?
No, I just he would probably laugh.
Do people drink that anymore?
No, I was just thinking about that the other day. I was writing some Billy Bleach, and I remembered it came back to me. Yeah. Light and lager.
Light and lager. Which is top. Which is, what is light and lager?
It's
half lager.
Half lager, half light ale.
Light ale.
Lager top's a bit of lemonade. Yeah.
But light and lager feels like, why? What's the point in that?
Why would you do that?
Yeah.
I remember having it, playing pool, and blokes with half a lager and a bottle of light ale. I think it's just boredom.
Mixing it up.
You see the light ale there, and go, what about that? Try that.
It's pissed.
Yeah, rather like most of these craft beers are.
So, well, look, we're going to play out with your second choice of songs. Before we do, why don't you just remind us of the dates you're in Edinburgh? What's it?
I'm in Edinburgh from the 16th of August to the 20th. Is that 5 days or is that four? I'm selecting 16th, 17th. Yeah, 5 days. 20, at the Pleasance, and it's around lunchtime. I balked a bit when they told me it was around 2 o'clock, and I went, what?
Yeah.
And they said, no,
like, fuck off.
Stuart Lee did it last year. So I went, okay, it's good enough for Stuart Lee.
Yeah. Do you know what? I actually think there's something about those daytime shows that are... there's definitely some pluses in doing it during the day.
Yeah.
You can get home and get to bed early.
Yeah, go home and watch some televised sport.
So you're on then, and then you haven't got dates for your tour yet.
It's in October. I haven't got dates on me, but they're online. Just Simon Day in Character 2017.
I can't wait to see it. I'm a little bit gutted that you're not doing Competitive Dad Live, but well, I don't know how you would do
that. We did it in the
Far
Show thing. It didn't work that well. But this is the problem. I was doing my show the other night, and it was like people saying, oh, aren't you doing Dave Angel? And you kind of can't please everyone.
No.
It's very difficult. You want to do one character, like Al Murray, that's it.
Yeah. What would a Dave Angel show be for an hour?
Well, also, they're going, are you doing Dave Angel? I said, no, because global warming is not funny anymore.
That's true.
It really isn't.
That is true. Yeah, God. Okay, so this is the song. It's Mona Lisa from Nat King Cole, by Nat King Cole.
In the film.
Film is it from? Is it from Mona Lisa? Do they use it in that
film? Yeah, the film Mona Lisa, with Kathy Tyson, Bob Hoskins.
I love that film.
It's a brilliant
film. Is that Neil Jordan?
Yeah, Neil Jordan. It's a great movie.
He made some good films, didn't he?
He did. And he's made one recently, actually.
Has he?
No, he was involved in that terrible TV series, but he suddenly came out and said, I wasn't involved in it. Forget it.
Stick
Riviera.
With, yeah. Hot potatoing that show. Riviera. He was involved in that.
It first came out, he was writing it.
Yeah.
So everyone watched it. And then one went, this is terrible. He can't have written this, you know.
Yeah.
And he came out and said, no, I was initially involved in some plot lines, but it didn't pan out. So I'm nothing to do with it. So please don't watch it thinking I've written it or directed it.
Oh, man. I bet the production company are happy with that.
Crying Game, he did too, didn't he?
Yeah, he did Crying Game. Interview with a Vampire, did he do that? I think he might have done.
I think he did.
But Mona Lisa is a fantastic film. Bob Hoskins was such a good actor.
I know.
I loved him so much. You could do a Bob Hoskins character.
What?
There you go, done.
I should see him walking around with his headphones on, learning his lines. When I lived in Primrose Hill in the good old days. Before the children came along.
And ruined your
lifestyle. Wanted somewhere to sleep.
Weren't happy with a bedsit overlooking the park.
Exactly. I used to say, my missus said, we've got to move. It's too small for the kids. And I said, look, it's better to be an unemployed actor living in Primrose Hill than an unemployed actor living in Wilston.
I don't know. I think the kids, you know, when they get to their teens, they go, I get it, Dad. All those years we were miserable.
Walks past and goes, what? My son goes, what? We lived here. You lived here. Did you have more money then? And I was like, no.
What are you saying? Okay, so this is Mona Lisa by Nat King Cole. Simon, it's been wonderful chatting to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dan.
Mona Lisa, men have named you. You're so like the lady with the mystic smile. Is it only 'cause you're lonely they have blamed you for that Mona Lisa strangeness in your smile. Do you smile to tempt a lover, Mona Lisa? Or is this your way to hide a broken heart? Many dreams have been brought to your doorstep. They just lie there and they die there. Are you warm? Are you real? Mona Lisa, are just a cold and lonely, lovely work of art. Smile to tempt a lover, Mona Lisa. Or is this your way to hide a broken heart? Many dreams have been brought to your doorstep. They just lie there and they die there. Are you warm? Are you real? Mona Lisa, are just a cold and lonely, lovely work of art. Mona Lisa, Mona Lisa.
Screen Talk with Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.